back in 2008, they actually took a SARS-like coronavirus and they put in a segment of the genome from the HIV/AIDS virus that would enable this new pathogen, genetically engineered in the lab, to infect human pulmonary tissue. That's published in something called the Journal of Virology, 2008. You can look it up. Why would you create a dangerous pathogen like that? I don't know. Is this the China virus that we're now dealing with? We don't know. We need to have the lab research and results. The other thing that people need to know is that in 2013, they were collecting from Chinese horseshoe bats all of these viruses, these SARS-like coronaviruses, because the bats contain many, and they found a couple of the SARS-like coronaviruses that were capable, without being engineered at all, of directly infecting human cells. So again, they took a virus that was safely in a horseshoe bat, brought it into the lab, put it in contact with human cells, found that they could infect and kill human cells. That's in the lab in Wuhan. That's why we need the records. We need to know if that virus, which they isolated and brought in from the wild into their lab, escaped from the lab. It's a reasonable question. I think that President Trump should call President Xi and ask him to release all of the research records of all of the dangerous coronaviruses that this Institute of Virology has been working on for the last decade and a half. Let's see the numbers. Let's see the genetic code. Let's see if there's a match between what we're facing in this pandemic and what they've been hosting in the lab for the last 10 years. If there is a match, then they're responsible, not just for the spread of the epidemic, which they are, by mismanagement. They're also responsible for the origin of the epidemic.
Our guest for this special live stream hangout is Dr. Steve Mosier. He was on a previous episode. That would be episode number 170, I think. 167. Talking about his book, Bully of Asia. He has appeared on just about every mainstream and Christian media platform. He's the first American social scientist to be allowed into China in 1979, where he witnessed women under the boot of the communistic one-child policy only, and he exposed that to the world. He is fluent in Chinese. He's lived there. And he's also the founder and head of the Population Research Institute, whose website, pop.org, we will be handsomely displaying. Dr. Mosier, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here with you.
You've been writing a lot. I've been visiting your coronavirus link, and there's lots to say because the different angles of the story keep arising almost daily. There's a new revelation or there's a new set of statistics that kind of domesticates or kind of undermines the nonstop media fueled hype. Never a dull moment. It just seems like you're writing every single day. Is that an overstatement?
Oh, there's no shortage of things to write about, from human rights violations in all of the border regions of China to persecution of the Catholic Church, to, of course, the coronavirus epidemic, which began in China and has made its way to our shores. It, in fact, may have made its way to my throat. So if I cough into my elbow, you'll understand and the listeners will understand why. I'm getting over it. I'm fine, but I do have a residual cough. I apologize for that. But I will say that everybody who has a cough in the United States from the Chinese coronavirus, everybody who becomes seriously ill, which I haven't, thank God, everyone who needs to be hospitalized, put on a ventilator, and of course, sadly, those who pass away in the U.S. and in the world and in China, they're all victims, every last one of them, of the Chinese Communist Party. So you began by saying, let's call this the Chinese Communist Party coronavirus, or the CCP virus for short. I absolutely salute you for doing that. This is on them. In many, many ways that we can talk about.
Well, first of all, it was manufactured there, which is to say its origin was there. I was going to ask you about patient zero. I understand from a link to a a Chinese news source, a health news source, that as far as the government is releasing, patient zero was discovered in about November of 2019. Is that your understanding? If there is even such a thing as patient zero, which I understand is critical to understand the spread of things like this.
Well, you know, you normally trace back an epidemic to its beginnings, especially when you have a case like this where the virus probably originally was in a Chinese horseshoe bat, which are known to contain lots and lots of coronaviruses. But I don't believe that it came directly from a Chinese horseshoe bat into a human being. I believe that it was collected by the Wuhan Institute of Virology, located in Wuhan, China, which is the epicenter of the epidemic, the original epicenter, of course, and still has lots of cases today. We know the Wuhan Institute of Virology used to brag in a tweet that's now been taken down for obvious reasons. They used to brag that they have more viruses in stock in the Wuhan Institute of Virology than any other Institute of Virology, any other biolab in the entire world. They said, we have 1,500 different viruses, including many, many dangerous viruses, including many, many coronaviruses, also dangerous, in the laboratory that we're investigating, doing research on. Now, I believe, and we don't have any direct evidence of this, but there's lots of indirect evidence of this, that if they started with 1,500 viruses in the lab, maybe now they only have 1,499 because guess what? One seems to have gotten away from them. I believe it leaked from the lab by poor lab protocol into a lab assistant, a lab researcher, who then went out into the street and communicated it to others. Now, people may have heard about the Wuhan seafood market.
Yep.
That was the original place where the government of China, which doesn't always tell the truth, you may be surprised to learn, the government of China originally said, yes, it originated in the fresh meat market of the Wuhan seafood market.
Yep.
Later on, researchers discovered that patient zero, and this goes back to November 17th of 2019. Patient zero, the first person that we know who had this dangerous, deadly coronavirus, never visited the Wuhan seafood market, never came anywhere close. So patient zero got it from somewhere else. I would like to know what his name is, where he lives, and most importantly, did he work at the Wuhan Institute of Virology?
Yeah, I got some, as you're talking there, I put some slides up, full screen, of the Wuhan wet seafood market, which is what we say, like a three iron away from the Institute of Virology, certainly within walking distance in Wuhan.
Yeah, there are two biolabs in Wuhan. One is the Chinese Center for Disease Control Biolab, which is literally just 100 yards away from the Wuhan seafood market. The other one, Wuhan Institute of Virology, is a couple miles away. But, you know, in terms of a virus and human beings traveling here and there, that's no distance at all. Remember that a virus doesn't have wings, it doesn't have legs, it can't swim, it can't fly. It is carried by its human host from one place to another, where it then infects other people. That's why social distancing does work.
Yeah.
So back to the point. The point is that in November and December, when this coronavirus, the Wuhan flu, the China virus, began to spread, the horseshoe bats were all in hibernation 900 miles away. There are no horseshoe bats locally at the Wuhan seafood market or anywhere else because they hibernate in the winter.
Yeah.
So I believe the virus was in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It was being looked at, researched, experimented on, and got out of the lab. Now, the Chinese government can easily prove me wrong. The Chinese Communist Party can easily prove me wrong. All they have to do, Patrick, is release all of the research that has been done in the Wuhan Institute of Virology on dangerous SARS-like coronaviruses. Now, SARS is sudden acute respiratory syndrome, SARS. We had an epidemic of SARS back in 2003. Hey, in 2004, it leaked twice from a Chinese biolab. So these labs have a history of leaking. this is a, what we're facing now is a SARS-like a coronavirus. That's why it's called SARS-CoV-2, because it's a second variety of SARS coronavirus that has gone into the human population and caused massive numbers of death. Now, the other thing we know about the Wuhan Institute of Virology is that they've been studying these dangerous SARS-like coronaviruses for the last 12 years. Back in 2008, they actually took a SARS-like coronavirus and they put in a segment of the genome from the HIV-AIDS virus that would enable this new pathogen genetically engineered in the lab to infect human pulmonary tissue. That's published in something called the Journal of Virology, 2008. You can look it up. Why would you create a dangerous pathogen like that? I don't know. Is this the China virus that we're now dealing with? We don't know. We need to have the lab research and results. The other thing that people need to know is that in 2013, they were collecting from Chinese horseshoe bats all of these viruses, these SARS-like coronaviruses, because the bats contain many, and they found a couple of the SARS-like coronaviruses that were capable, without being engineered at all, of directly infecting human cells. So again, they took a virus that was safely in a horseshoe bat, brought it into the lab, put it in contact with human cells, found that they could infect and kill human cells. That's in the lab in Wuhan. That's why we need the records. We need to know if that virus, which they isolated and brought in from the wild into their lab, escaped from the lab. It's a reasonable question. I think that President Trump should call President Xi and ask him to release all of the research records of all of the dangerous coronaviruses that this Institute of Virology has been working on for the last decade and a half. Let's see the numbers. Let's see the genetic code. Let's see if there's a match between what we're facing in this pandemic and what they've been hosting in the lab for the last 10 years. If there is a match, then they're responsible, not just for the spread of the epidemic, which they are, by mismanagement. They're also responsible for the origin of the epidemic.
In the interest of international fraternity, aren't we fighting the same tiny individual enemy? And Xi Jinping has a huge motive to clear his name, because I understand within China it's called the Xi virus already. He's already taking, he has his growing number of critics who seem to be disappearing with increasing frequency. Wouldn't that disprove any conspiracy theory that it was an American bioweapon used against China? Because that's part of the Chinese media narrative now, is it not?
Well, that was probably one of the most bizarre propaganda ploys ever to come out of the People's Republic of China. This is like the kind of propaganda we heard in the 1950s during the Taiwan Straits crises when China was getting ready to invade Taiwan. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of propaganda we heard during the Korean War, where American soldiers were said to be eating Korean babies. Literally, that was in the propaganda. Yes. This kind of propaganda you heard during the Vietnam War. We haven't heard this from China over the last 30 years because they've been too busy taking advantage of our open markets, taking advantage of our technology, taking advantage of financing from the United States. And so until recently, they've wanted to make nice to us because they were busy bleeding us dry of money and commercially useful, militarily useful technology. Now, of course, they've got their backs to the wall. Now they've caused not only a major epidemic within China, probably by very poor biolab practice, they've also caused a pandemic around the world. This will fundamentally change the way the world looks at China. It certainly should change the way the world looks at China. You've heard about the Great Wall of China. I'm hoping that the reaction to the coronavirus pandemic will be the great fall of China, the great fall in terms of international prestige and esteem, and ultimately, of course, the great fall of the Chinese Communist Party, which deserves to be dumped into the dustbin of history sooner rather than later.
Here's one thread of the narrative that I've heard quite frequently, and that is that the China virus or the CCP virus was as a result of a punishment on President Trump for tariffs slapped on China, and that President Trump is the one who has blood on his hands. It's a variation of the one we just talked about. Do you believe that if you just despise the president, there's no rationale that's going to penetrate the impulse or the animus against him? Because even when he mentioned a couple of days ago that he'd like to get the country back to work so that, you know, the international market isn't utterly wrecked, he's damned if he did and damned if he doesn't. Do or don't, because if he announces, let's say it's April 12th, and on April 13th someone dies of the China virus, guess who's at fault? Guess who doesn't care about human life?
Yeah, he just can't win for losing in the eyes of the mainstream media. He is. They're all suffering from what's become known as TDS, Trump Derangement Syndrome. They're no longer thinking rationally about this man and his presidency. Because if you look objectively at what he's done across the board in terms of, until recently, the economic growth, the wages going up for the middle class and the working class, the pro-life protections that have been put in place overseas. Mm-hmm. We know, for example, we just found out from a report that we're doing at the Population Research Institute that the Trump administration has denied $153 million to the International Planned Parenthood Federation and the British abortion group Marie Stopes International. $153 million has been denied them in funding over the last couple of years. Because why? Because of the President Trump's Mexico City policy, which denies any federal funding to any international group that promotes abortion, performs abortion, or lobbies for the legalization of abortion overseas. That's a great victory. That will save many, many lives of unborn children around the world. And the list goes on and on and on. Now, you may not agree with President Trump on all these issues, or you may have problems with his style, but I think the substance is so impressive that, hey, I really don't care about the style at all. I mean, the man is getting things done. He is getting things done in a brash New Yorker way, but he's saving the United States from the kind of social engineering we would have seen under a pro-abortion administration. And if you can imagine how the Clinton administration, which never happened, would have been reacting to the China virus, to the Wuhan flu, we should all thank God that this man is in the Oval Office at this time, because otherwise, certainly a President Clinton would seize this opportunity to radically transform America, to make abortion on demand up to childbirth the law of the land forever, to put in place all kinds of policies that would undermine the economy, destroy the middle class, and ultimately wind up with China, not the United States, being the dominant power in the world.
Well, his famous book is not The Art of the Feelings or The Art of the Fishing Rod, but The Art of the Deal. I know there's at least one lawsuit filed, I believe, yesterday in Texas by Larry Klayman for, I want to say, $22 trillion, trillion with a TR, to make China pay for the unbelievable financial cost incurred by the United States. Do you think President Trump will go after the Xi Jinping regime to at least forgive debt, if not financial recompense for the things we've had to pay for, thanks to their mistakes?
There certainly should be a reckoning against China soon. And it should be a reckoning against China done not just by the United States, but by every country that has suffered from the China virus, from the Wuhan flu. Now, let me go back and say that we signed this trade deal, I believe on February 14th with China, where they were to buy $200 billion worth of U.S. goods over the next 2 years. Remember that Xi Jinping, President Xi, already knew at that point that he had a major epidemic on his hands and that that epidemic was likely to spread to other countries. So I believe that whole deal was negotiated in bad faith. And people need to understand this. The Chinese Communist Party now has already come back to the American negotiators and said, you know, we won't be able to keep our side of the bargain because we're suffering from this epidemic. this coronavirus epidemic. And so we'd like you to release us from our obligation to buy $200 billion of U.S. goods. The answer to that is an emphatic no. You sign the agreement, you will keep the agreement. If you violate the agreement, the tariffs, which were partially reduced, not entirely reduced, mm-hmm. will go back up on Chinese goods, and factories, businesses will continue abandoning China for places like China, Mexico, Canada, and the United States. Mm-hmm. That's step number one. Step number two is to say to China, you caused tremendous damage to the American economy. We are not going to honor the trillion-plus dollars in debt, U.S. government denominated debt that you hold. That's your down payment on the economic damage you caused to the United States by your mishandling of the epidemic. You see, as everyone knows by now, we were ready to send in the top virologists in the world to look at the cause of the epidemic when it was confined largely to the city of Wuhan. Mm-hmm. And if we had been able to begin doing research in very, very late December or early January, we would have figured out a lot of things about the virus that we're only now learning 3 months later.
And meanwhile,
that would have enabled us to stop the spread of the virus within China. It certainly would have stopped it from becoming a global pandemic. China denied us access to the research that we would have been able to do. Also, local officials in the province of Hubei, where Wuhan City is located, ordered labs to destroy their samples of the China virus, to destroy their samples of this coronavirus that were being investigated, that were being genetically sequenced, and that were being used to develop a test for this coronavirus. Mm-hmm. So they actually set back the research that was being done in China itself. I mean, how much more culpable can you be? There's no question about their guilt in starting the pandemic. There is now, thanks to Congressman Banks of Indiana, a resolution before the House of Representatives to condemn China for having spread this pandemic throughout the world. And it lists, date by date, all of the things that the Communist Party did, not to stop the epidemic, but that actually contributed to the spread of the epidemic. And I will tell you quite frankly, Patrick, I don't know whether it's incompetence or evil, or a combination of both, more likely. And again, we don't know where the original origin was. And that will compound China's responsibility even more if we can prove that it came from the lab. But at every step of the way, they have done things that make the pandemic that we're now all experiencing worse, not better. They behave totally irresponsibly. And this is the country that wants to become the leader of the world. This is the country that wants to dominate the United Nations and other international organizations. This is a country that shouldn't be allowed, out of its own borders, for goodness sake. They're a danger to themselves and others.
For 6 to 8 weeks, thousands of flights were permitted to take off from Wuhan City. For Americans who don't have a sense of the scope or the size of a city like that, in American terms, that's a very large city. I want to say between 9 and 11 million people live in Wuhan.
Yeah, there are 11 million people who are residents of Wuhan. There are normally 4 or 5 million people who are workers in Wuhan factories who don't have an urban residence permit, because in China, dictatorial, totalitarian China, you can't live where you want. You have to have a residence permit from the government. So there were about 5 million people illegally resident in the city of Wuhan who, when the Chinese New Year took place in mid to late January, all left Wuhan to go back to their towns and villages where they were from. Mm-hmm. It's like, in terms of spreading an epidemic, it's like setting off a nuclear weapon in the downtown Wuhan. And the fallout fell all over China and all over the world. And again, if they had stopped the exodus from Wuhan of these 5 million people who went everywhere in China and everywhere in the world, the epidemic could have been contained to Wuhan. That was already late in the game by late January. This should have been done in late November or mid-December. It wasn't.
And that's why the suffix 19, its year of discovery was last year, not last Tuesday. Yeah. If you've just joined us on this live stream hangout with Dr. Stephen Mosier, my name's Patrick Coffin. Check out coffinnation.com. Dr. Mosier is the author of a growing passel of books, including Bully of Asia. That was episode 167 of my weekly podcast. I didn't anticipate having you back on, Dr. Mosier, because at that point, no one dreamed that we'd be in virtual militarized lockdown. I want to ask you about the censorship that you have undergone as a journalist, as a researcher, and commentator. Let me just show this. Don't buy China's story. The coronavirus may have leaked from a lab. This is February 22nd, 2020. That was censored by our good friends at our good friends at Facebook, correct? Then they put a little reader warning label on it.
It was censored by Facebook. There are a number of people who have been talking about the possibility that the Wuhan flu, the China virus, leaked from the bio lab in Wuhan. It's a reasonable thing to think happened because of the history of leaks from Chinese bio labs, because of the poor lab protocol that's often followed, because of the fact that, believe it or not, that infected lab animals that have been used in research and who have survived whatever virus they were infected with are sometimes sold on what's called the wet meat market, where they are killed. People buy live animals and they're slaughtered right in front of them. The guts, the entrails are spilled on the street.
Yep.
There's blood everywhere. And then they're handed to the buyer to take back home and cook and eat.
This is making me hungry.
Oh, it makes me. Yeah, well, I won't say what it makes me. But, I'm not the only one to suggest that it may have escaped from the lab. A number of people have suggested that. Senator Tom Cotton, for example, raised that question. And what Facebook did was go to a group called, what was the group called? It was called Health.
Their fact-checking brigade?
Their fact-checking group was called Health Feedback. And Health Feedback went, very interestingly, to a virologist who lives in the city of Singapore. And she actually works with the Wuhan Institute of Virology researchers because her university, the National University of Singapore, is an international partner of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And I will tell you, this woman raked me over the coals for having the temerity to suggest that it might have escaped from the lab. She said her Chinese colleagues would never have allowed that to happen, that the lab is a perfect example of scientific research at its best, on and on and on. It turns out, Patrick, get this, her joint project with the Wuhan Institute of Virology is called Combating the Next SARS-like Emerging Infectious Disease Outbreak by Improving Active Surveillance. So her job, she was working with researchers at the Wuhan Institute of Virology to combat the next infectious disease outbreak by improving active surveillance. Obviously, they failed to do what they said they were going to do because we now have the next outbreak. So I guess she and her Chinese research colleagues at the Wuhan Biolab are now moving on from the current epidemic to the next one. Because guess what? They missed this one big time.
It sounds like they have a history of failing to keep bad stuff in test tubes.
Yeah, they really do. And the people in the United States who are criticizing myself, who are criticizing Senator Cotton and others, I don't know what their reasons are. Why are they apologizing for China? In some cases, it's obvious to see. They're protecting themselves and their reputations, right? Because they've worked at this bio lab, and if it leaks, if it started a pandemic, their reputations are going to suffer as well. In some ways, I think some of them are trying to shift blame away from China to America. They're just globalists. They believe in the international scientific community. That trumps patriotism or feeling for their fellow citizens. And some of them, they just want to blame President Trump And they don't like me stepping on the narrative that actually the fault is all China's.
Let me make one thing clear, and I'll just lay out a premise, and you can pile on, because I'm already getting comments inside the YouTube comment box that stop calling it China. It really should be CCP. This reminds me of people like Venerable Fulton Sheen, who would very trenchantly and bluntly and continually criticize communism inside the former Soviet Union. But he had a great love of Russians. He loved Russian people. His own chalice was given him as a from a Russian Orthodox historical background. So let me just kind of clear the air. You're not anti-Chinese people, because I know this is another thing that's going to be thrown your way. Just that's what I wanted to throw out there.
I left the field of biology and oceanography out of my love for the Chinese people. I studied Chinese at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, which, of course, was the center of the student protests that took place over the last few months. I have many friends in Hong Kong. I was the first American social scientist in China. I have many friends in China and lived in Taiwan for several years. I spent a decade of my life in Asia. I love the Chinese people. The Chinese people are, let's be clear, the first and foremost victims of the Chinese Communist Party, which has now been in power for 70 years. Mm-hmm. They're the first and foremost victims, certainly in numerical terms, because if you add up the number of people who were killed in the land reforms, in the anti-rightist campaigns of the 1950s, during the Cultural Revolution, during the Great Leap Forward famine in the early 1960s, right. The number of people who were killed, unborn children who were killed in the one-child policy, we're talking over 100 million victims, Chinese victims, of the Chinese Communist Party. I feel for them. I have spoken out on human rights violations in China, principally because I wanted to speak out on their behalf to help save them from these horrendous human rights abuses. And that's why I'm speaking out now. This is, okay, I'm happy to call it the CCP virus, but make sure we let people know that CCP stands for Chinese Communist Party. This is a made by the Chinese Communist Party viral pandemic. All right.
Maybe commie virus has more of a hook to it.
I'll go with that too. I'm happy. Now, anything that eliminates real criminals here.
Right. Well, you and I have not rehearsed any of this. I just want to give you a chance to sound off on a charge that's already been leveled against me. But what cracks me up is that our SJW brethren have no scruples about calling it the West Nile virus or the Spanish flu. All of a sudden, you can't name the country of its actual historical origin. So, listen,
and Lyme disease comes from, Lyme, Connecticut. I have nothing against the people who live in Lyme, Connecticut. And as far as I know, they're not rioting in the streets because we call it the Lyme disease.
Right. I just have the screen up. It's a snapshot of what Facebook censorship says. It says false information checked by independent fact checkers. And then it says CY. It's often interesting. I recommend that people go through there and do CY, find out what the rationale is. It'd be very educational. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask about people who get disappeared. Like Ren Zhiquang? He's a Communist Party member, a real estate magnet, insofar as you can be. Who is he, and what do you have to say about folks like him getting disappeared?
Well, he's only one of the most high-profile critics who have been taken to what are known in China as black jails. These are jails that prisons that don't formally exist, but they're maintained by the public security forces. And people are taken to them in order that they can then be out of sight of the public before any judicial proceeding, before any charges have been brought, where they can be brainwashed, where they can be tortured, where they can be subjected to various kinds of psychological pressures in order to get them to confess. This has happened many, many times throughout the history of the Chinese Communist Party. Remember that the Chinese Communist Party invented brainwashing, Patrick, back in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. Originally, it was called by a Chinese term, Xi Nao, which means wash brain. Literally, Xi means wash, Nao means
brain. Interesting.
Wash brain. And once the Chinese Communist Party began to practice it in their redoubt of Yan'an, China, where Mao Zedong went after the Long March, it became adopted by the West, became known as brainwashing. But this was a process of wearing down an individual's will to resist by constant struggle sessions, which went on from morning to night. And could continue on for weeks or even months. What will happen to Mr. Ren is this, probably because he's still a multi-billionaire, although he's now in danger of having his entire fortune confiscated by the government, mm-hmm. probably because he's a well-known Communist Party member. He won't be tortured with electric batons or cattle prods or had any of the other tortures inflicted on him that ordinary Chinese are subject to all the time. But he will have his will to resist worn down. And in 3 months or 6 months or 9 months, depending on how stalwart a character he is, he will be a broken man. He will be trotted out in front of the state television cameras, and he will confess abjectly to having been entirely wrong, entirely wrong in his criticism of the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping. He will praise Xi Jinping as having done a wonderful job in combating the viral epidemic and having China serve as a model for how to combat the epidemic to other countries around the world. And he will apologize for his misdeeds. That has happened before to other critics of Xi Jinping, and it will happen again. We are now back in... we have regressed in political terms in China probably 50 years. We are now back in the days of Chairman Mao Zedong, who would do the same kinds of things to his enemies that President for Life Xi Jinping is doing now. I don't even like to call him president because that suggests that he's somehow democratically elected. This is a man who rose to the top of the Chinese Communist Party's power pyramid by factional struggles, by backstabbing, by toadying up to the former leader, and by pretending to everybody that he really was not a very ambitious individual and he would simply try to balance all the factions. Well, once he got to power, he completely destroyed the other factions and now reigns supreme at the top of the power pyramid. He's not a very nice man. He's the general secretary of a conspiratorial communist party, which is responsible for the murder of over 100 million Chinese. It's the biggest killing machine in the history of the world.
We should mention that Ren Zhequang called Xi Jinping a clown for his handling of the CCP virus. That is an amazing metric. To me, that is the tip of an iceberg of discontent. Do you think this could topple his regime? Could this be the end of the dictator's reign?
Well, here's an interesting fact about the initial reaction of the Xi Jinping-led Beijing regime, communist regime, to the outbreak in Wuhan. Their initial reaction was not to send in medical workers, nurses and doctors, or medical supplies. That came later, and that was the subject of a great propaganda barrage. But the first thing they did, Patrick, before they did anything else, was they sent in the military and they sent in additional police units to the city of Wuhan and to the province of Hubei. So what was their first concern? Was it the health of the people of Wuhan? No. Was it stopping the spread of the virus and finding a cure? No. Their first concern was politics. And remember, Chairman Mao famously said, political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Mm-hmm. And Xi Jinping, as a student of the former, the great helmsman, as we used to call Chairman Mao, wanted to make sure that he had guns at the ready before he did anything else because he was worried about an uprising in the face of this epidemic. Mm-hmm. They locked down on January 2nd, before the world knew about the Wuhan flu, the CCP virus. They locked down all of the military installations in and around the city of Wuhan. And they did it because they wanted to make sure that the soldiers and the policemen did not contract the virus. They wanted them to be healthy because they would be needed. They would be needed in the event of an uprising.
Could this lead to a social media powered sequel to the 1989 Tiananmen Square confrontation? Because this is 1989 was the very early infancy of the internet. There was none of the current platforms that are available as commonly used today existed in 1989. Is some kind of clash coming between the oligarchs inside China and the real people, as opposed to the people of communist propaganda?
Yeah. Let's go back to 1989 when there were a million people marching in the streets of Beijing. Not just students, mm-hmm. but workers, mm-hmm. and even some government employees were marching in the streets of Beijing and Shanghai and Chengdu and Guangzhou and other cities, demanding an end to one-party dictatorship, demanding an end to excessive bureaucratization, demanding an end to corruption. And they occupied the central square of China's capital city, Tiananmen Square, for weeks on end. The then leader of the Chinese Communist Party, Zhao Ziyang, wanted to negotiate with the students. He was a reformer. He said to the other senior leaders like Deng Xiaoping, who was then retired, let's go and talk to the students. Maybe we can reform. There is corruption in the party. There is a problem with excessive bureaucracy. Let's see if we can't move towards a more open society. Deng Xiaoping, who had the loyalty of the army behind him, immediately ousted Zhao Ziyang and then told the military, we must put down this uprising. It's all right if you shed a little blood. Well, that's exactly what the military did. They had their orders. They went in and they shed not just a little blood, they shed a lot of blood. They claim only a couple hundred people died. There were at least 10,000 people who were killed in and around Tiananmen Square and in the streets of Beijing municipality. Mm-hmm. And to make matters worse, for everyone who was killed, there were probably two or three wounded, right? Who had wounds in their arms and legs, who'd been hit by a tank but not killed. Those wounded were all in the Beijing's hospitals and clinics being cared for by medical workers. When the very next day, columns of trucks pulled up in front of every clinic, every hospital in the city of Beijing, and collected all of the wounded, taking them out of the ICU, taking them out of the wards where they were being cared for. They were dumped on the backs of trucks. They were taken out to an undisclosed location, and none of them has ever been seen again. Mm-hmm. That's called destroying the evidence. Each of those people who would have healed over time with a bullet scar in their arm or a bullet scar in their torso would have been walking, living evidence of the brutality of the Chinese Communist Party. They had to be killed, and they were. Well, those are the people who are still in charge of China today, Patrick. So we know, and the Chinese people know even better than we do, that any sign of discontent, any mobilization against the regime will be met immediately with massive deadly force.
Another student of Mao, the greatest mass murderer in history.
Right.
Again, if you just joined us, this live stream hangout features the founder and president of the Population Research Institute, POP.org. Let me just throw up the title link of the link where you can find the latest updates. There it is. I'm obviously a master of this. Okay, here we go. POP.org/coronavirus, POP.org/coronavirus. Not all countries' responses are created equal. The president of Taiwan,
President Tsai Ing-wen.
So she seemed to have what's the phrase? She had the number of this thing. Her measures, I'm sure, were criticized as a little bit too harsh. What did she do, and how did Taiwan's reaction to the initial spread of this virus distinguish itself from, say, Italy or the U.S.?
Well, Taiwan is an island off the southeast coast of China. At its closest point, it's only 90 miles away from the mainland. There is a lot of traffic between Taiwan and mainland China. Mm-hmm. A lot of Taiwan mm-hmm. businessmen have factories and businesses in the mainland. When the first cases began to emerge in Wuhan, the Chinese CDC, not the Chinese CDC, but the Taiwanese CDC, immediately became aware of it and notified President Tsai. President Tsai was the first leader of a country to stop direct flights from Wuhan, China, to the island of Taiwan. She did it early. She even beat President Trump. He was a couple days later than President Tsai. And because she did that, because she stopped people who were potentially carrying the CCP virus from traveling from China to Taiwan, yeah. they have kept the number of cases down to an incredibly low level, just a few dozen cases. Mm-hmm. The entire island of Taiwan, of course, has for decades been on the alert for threats from mainland China. Remember that beginning in the 50s and continuing on now into 2020, the leaders of China have constantly threatened to invade Taiwan, to take back a free and independent Taiwan into the suffocating embrace of the motherland. So one reason President Tsai reacted so quickly is because the people of Taiwan, which is a democratic country, which has regular elections and respects human rights and has a free market economy, the democratic government of Taiwan is always worried about various threats from mainland China, economic, trade threats, technological threats, cyber attacks, and, of course, a military attack. This was an attack of a different kind, but it was spotted early and stopped. The other reason that Taiwan was on high alert was this. Taiwan suffered during the SARS epidemic of 2003 because SARS was largely but not entirely contained to China. There were cases in Taiwan. People died. So again, China was seen by Taiwan as possibly the source of a future pandemic. And so the Taiwan Center for Disease Control was ready for it. Mm-hmm. They had pre-deployed masks. They had pre-deployed protective equipment to be used by medical workers. They were ready for another epidemic to come from China because just a few years before, one had in fact come. So for all these reasons, Taiwan has kept the number of deaths down to a handful and has kept the number of infected down to a few dozen. They've done everything right. If you want an example of a country that's done everything wrong, you can look at Iran, which is lying about the number of coronavirus cases, is certainly lying about the number of deaths from the coronavirus. There are actually satellite photos of graveyards, graves being dug in around Iranian cities, graves, mass graves that are as long as football fields where the corpses are being put in and covered up. There are thousands and thousands of deaths in Iran that are not being reported. Why did Iran get so much of the CCP virus? Why did they get so many infections? Because Iran is an important terminus of China's Belt and Road Initiative, what China calls the New Silk Road, which is supposed to bring riches and investment from China into the countries that participate. Well, Iran participated in the New Silk Road, and what came down the New Silk Road was not silk, was not riches, but death. And Iran is paying a price for its very close relations to the People's Republic of China today.
They certainly share that landmass, If folks are not familiar with the Rand McNally Atlas, it's not inconceivable that there'd be roadway connections there. I want to switch now to, I got questions from Coffin Nation members. Maybe we can start with Brad Udpatel. Brad asks, it's longishly phrased, but it goes to a guest I'm going to be having in the on the show, the Patrick Coffin Show podcast, in a couple of weeks. That's retired Brigadier General Robert Spalding, who has a book called Stealth War. And he, I have not read the book yet, but I understand that while America's elites were sleeping, China has become really muscularized. I want to get your opinion, based on Brad's question here. Is China already, you know, gaining this hegemony they've wanted for so long? And are they on the rebound of more aggression after 100 years of basically bad luck under official communism? You and I talked when you were on episode number 167 about Bully of Asia, that China's international ambitions go back before the time of Christ. This is not something that you can pin on modern communism only. That's a long, it's a lot of data.
Let me start with Taiwan. We were just talking about Taiwan and the constant threats that issue from Beijing, that issue from President Xi Jinping himself about using military force to recover Taiwan. Xi Jinping has actually said that 2020 will be the year that Taiwan rejoins Greater China. That's the year that we find ourselves in right now. He said this 4 years ago. Now, I'm very afraid that China, by which I mean not the Chinese people, but the Chinese Communist Party and its leader, President Xi, will decide that in order to distract the Chinese people from the terrible suffering that has been caused by this preventable epidemic, that they need to engage in a foreign adventure. Well, what foreign adventure might beckon to them at this moment? Well, the idea of trying to recover Taiwan. In the past, 20 or 30 years ago, this has always been empty bluff and bluster because China had no amphibious force. They had no landing craft. They had no way to transport an army across the Taiwan Straits, mm-hmm. land successfully on Taiwan's heavily defended beaches, and then take over the island. In the past 20 years, they have remedied that defect. They do now have a very capable force of Chinese Marines. They have landing ships. They have a very formidable Navy. They have an Air Force that vastly outnumbers the Air Force of Taiwan. Remember, Taiwan only has a population of 24 million people. China has 1.3 million people. So they are now in a position to act on the threats that they've been making for the last 70 years. There have been a couple of incidents, one around Quemoy, that suggest increased Chinese aggressiveness. There was another incident just a couple days ago where several Chinese, quote-unquote, fishing boats went into Taiwan territorial waters, and they were being chased off by a Taiwanese frigate when they started ramming the frigate. They were taking turns ramming the frigate. The frigate didn't open fire. It eventually retreated. This is the kind of aggressive behavior on the part of these Chinese fishing boats that we haven't seen before. So is China seeking to create a pretext for war against Taiwan? I don't know, but I would suggest that everyone in the U.S. 7th Fleet, and I used to be with the U.S. 7th Fleet. I was an engineering officer during the last days of the Vietnam War with the U.S. 7th Fleet stationed in Yokosuka, Japan. I would advise everyone with the U.S. Pacific, Indo-Pacific Command and everyone at the Pentagon to watch China very, very closely, because internal turmoil inside of China may often create the conditions where President Xi, in order to preserve his power, in order to preserve the prestige of the Chinese Communist Party, seeks a quick victory overseas. So these are dangerous times for us, not just because of the CCP virus, but also because of possible aggression on the part of the Chinese Communist Party towards its neighbors.
It has the ring of kind of naval saber rattling. If they can provoke Taiwan, see, you know, where's the line when someone else is going to step in to help Taiwan fight back? You know, God forbid, that could become very ugly very quickly. Have you seen the, there is a press release from a medical website, and I want to get that slide up here. It has to do with the Johns Hopkins. Where is it here? Here we go. Yes, Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It's a statement about what they're calling NCOV, or the CCP virus, and our pandemic exercise. Apparently, I won't read the text, but it says, yeah, here it is there. Yeah, there it is up there. That in 2019, there was a kind of rehearsal, or a kind of, they're saying it wasn't a prediction, but it was an anticipation, almost like a war game exercise. What if? And they actually called it a coronavirus. This is back in early fall 2019. Do you believe this was planned, pre-rehearsed, in some way known beforehand? Or is this just another example of historical randomness? Mm-hmm.
2003 with SARS. We had it in 2010 and 11 with H1N1, the swine flu. Yeah. We should have seen this coming. And I will tell you, you can see written on President Trump's face the frustration that he showed during his early press conferences when he all but said, what was the Obama administration doing in 2010-2011, not only because of their late response to declaring the swine flu to be a national emergency, but also in not learning from that, that such a thing might happen 5 or 10 years down the road, mm-hmm. and planning, not just planning, but doing what Taiwan did, pre-deploying the resources you would need to deal with such an epidemic. I think when he went back to the CDC, they said, we have these plans, but we've never actually actuated them. We thought about creating a national stockpile of protective gear and face masks and everything, but we didn't actually do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's making up for that lapse, and I will tell you this: we will get through this CCP virus, I think, more quickly than people imagine, and after we do. I believe this administration will make sure that when the next dangerous virus emerges from China, which is probably the most likely place for it to come from, we will be ready this time. We will not be caught unprepared a second time.
Let's turn now to government response everywhere, basically, but also specifically inside the United States. I'm in California, and our dear leader, Governor Gavin Newsom, predicted last week, after his shelter-in-place lockdown was imposed in the entire state, that within 8 weeks, half of California would become infected. That's 26 million people. Nobody believes that. Governor Mike DeWine, otherwise a good man, I'm sure he's a good governor, he predicted 100,000 cases in Ohio. The body count doesn't match the projections in the models. Now, your numbers are your friends more than they are mine from a statistical demographic point of view. How do you read the numbers that are flung in our faces day and night as, given quasi-legitimation?
Well, I think that a lot of these people who are political, who have no background in statistics or mathematics, really don't understand exponential growth. If you have a virus that is being communicated to more than one person over a short length of time, the number of infected is going to grow. Mm-hmm. Now, the early projections, which were based on inaccurate, I believe falsified data from China, was that every person was infecting 2.6 other people, and that the infection time, the turnover rate for that, was about 6 days.
Yeah.
So in other words, every 6 days, you had the number of infected going up by a factor of 2.6. Well, you don't have to do that very many times before you get to 100,000. That was the number that Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio gave on March 13th. He said, we may already have 100,000 cases in the state of Ohio. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, you've only got 145 people hospitalized. You only had at that time 3 deaths. The numbers just don't add up. Today, of course, a week and a half, almost 2 weeks later, we would have, if those rates of growth held up, that if every person was communicating the disease to 2.6 other people every 6 days, then we would have 2/3 of a million people in Ohio infected with the virus. We would be seeing vastly more numbers of people infected, hospitalized, and the death rate would be climbing rapidly. We just don't see that. Now, having said that, I don't want to be too harsh on Governor DeWine. He's not a statistician. He's not a mathematician. He's just looking at these worst-case mathematical models that are being drawn up for him by epidemiologists who are taught, you know, we have to, you know, hope for the best but plan for the worst, Governor, so let's lock down the entire state.
The phrase that's used is out of an abundance of caution. Just want to let folks know, we had a 10-second sound muting for some reason. So I'm in the a position of repeating the question that Dr. Mosher is now answering, and that was the overkill and the wildly inflated number projections that have led some politicians to order things like the shelter-in-place lockdowns that we experience here in many states now. So, sorry, I guess the answer was... the question was muted here. Let us know if you can still hear me at this point. But you were...
I think it was the previous question.
Yeah, maybe it was the previous question. Which was? Yeah, we'll sort it out. Welcome to live broadcast, folks. You had another thought there. Just
Patrick, I did have another thought on that front, and that is that Oxford University has a Center for Evidence-Based Medicine, CEBM, and, of course, we need as much evidence-based medicine as we can get right now.
Right.
And they point out that during the early days of the swine flu, the rate of infection, the ROI, rate of infection, was calculated to be as great as 5. And as every one person was communicating it to 5 other people. Well, you can imagine what the numbers looked like after a few transmissions. They were huge. At the end of the H1N1 flu epidemic, when it had been brought to a halt, and they actually looked back at the numbers, they calculated that the rate of infection was much, much lower than that, and they calculated that the death rate, which had early been calculated to be 3%, 4%, or 5%, was actually down at 0.2%. 0.2% is a lot lower than 5% or 4% of the population. So you see how as the epidemic progresses, we get more and more accurate over time, and the numbers tend to fall. You see that in Great Britain now. The early estimates were 1 million deaths. Now we see people retracting that and saying, well, maybe we'll have 10,000 deaths. All right. Well, that's a pretty big difference. You're only off by a factor of 100. You know, you were close.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. The food in the Hindenburg was quite tasty. Yeah. To Governor DeWine's credit, he did shut down abortion clinics. I believe the governor of Texas did the same thing. One wag observed that in the 2 weeks that the Planned Parenthood abortuaries were shut down, more lives have been saved by a major factor than lives have been lost through the China virus. Thought that was interesting.
Amen.
Apparently, the question that got muted was, The question was the China virus a bioweapon? But one thing I didn't get to was, what are your thoughts on the thesis that it was deliberately designed and released accidentally on purpose from the Wuhan, the virology lab? Is that even knowable? And are you insane?
Once we have the records from China, which I'm sure that President Xi Jinping is going to be happy to release when President Trump requests it of him, we right. can do a comprehensive sequencing comparison of the genome in the Wuhan flu virus, which we call SARS-CoV-2, mm-hmm. with all the coronaviruses that the Wuhan Institute of Virology has isolated from the wild that it sequenced and studied. And we'll see if there's a match. And if there's a match, then it's obviously one of theirs. We'll also be able to find out whether it was in any way tinkered with, mm-hmm. genetically engineered to be made more lethal. Now, would China release a deadly pathogen on its own population? I find that hard to believe, not because of any concern on the part of the Chinese Communist Party for human life. All right? Let's be clear about that at the outset. When the Chinese National Health Commission met in early January to talk about how to deal with the Wuhan epidemic when it was in its early stages, mm-hmm. the director of the National Health Commission, who is a party hack, said, our priorities are politics first, politics number one, security number two, and number three, a cure and the safety of the Chinese people. Mm-hmm. Number one, politics. What does that mean? That means making the Chinese Communist Party look good, making the Chinese Communist Party to be the hero in this circumstance, even when it's the heel, even when it's responsible for the spread of the epidemic. Yeah. Number two, safety means quarantining the people who are sick, not curing them, but simply brutally cutting them off from the rest of the Chinese people in order to stop the disease from spreading. You know, when we talk about quarantine, we're talking about in the United States, you know, telling people you really should stay home for 2 weeks and only go out for essential things. In China, they were nailing up boards on the doors of people's apartments to prevent them from coming out. They were taking people by force who had a fever to detention centers and holding them. They call the detention centers hospitals. Hospitals have nurses. They have medical equipment. They have drugs. They have doctors. These were detention centers. They had very little of any of those things. They were just holding tanks where the people would live or die depending on their own immune systems. This was quarantine Chinese style. So there's no concern for the health and well-being of the Chinese people don't come first in dealing with crises like this. They come last. But would the Chinese Communist Party deliberately jeopardize its prestige, its standing, possibly create an uprising against it by releasing mm-hmm. a dangerous, lethal virus on its own population? I don't think so. I think if they were releasing it, the epidemic would have started in Italy. The epidemic would have started in several countries overseas, not in China itself.
I can never tell when footage was shot. There's several famous clips of him walking down some kind of medical institution hallway. He's saluting what appear to be doctors and nurses. It's not even clear if they're in the same room. But President Xi has this mask on and a parka. If he's the president, wouldn't he be in a full man of the plastic bubble hazmat gear?
Well, the staged managed propaganda scenes coming out of China, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. First of all, they may be actors. They may not even be real people to begin with. If they're real people, they may not be real tears. You know, you do mm-hmm. what the party tells you to do. And if you're all to cheer Xi Jinping as the great hero savior of the Chinese people, then you cheer. The consequences for not doing so are too horrible to contemplate. You simply right. go along with the what's being requested of you. Now, Xi Jinping actually disappeared from the stage for several weeks in January. And it wasn't until last week that he actually went to the epicenter of the epidemic, the city of Wuhan, mm-hmm. the first time. Imagine President Trump not go. Imagine the terrible epidemic breaking out in some place, and the president not going to the one place which had had a hurricane or which had had a tornado. Mm-hmm. If he didn't show up within 48 hours, he would be roundly criticized for his callousness. Well, Xi Jinping was missing in action, at least as far. As far as Wuhan was concerned, for a couple months. So I think that all the people in those stage-managed photos had tested negative for the CCP virus before they would be allowed within 100 yards of President for Life Xi Jinping. And also, we know this. We know that all of the aides de camp, all of the military officers who worked with the senior officers of the People's Liberation Army, Navy, and Air Force were themselves put in quarantine. They were told to stay in the barracks, away from their families, not to go out on the street, because they the central government didn't want anyone of the senior leaders in the military that they thought they might have to call on in the event of civil unrest, didn't want any senior members of the military to contract the CCP virus. And as far as we know, they didn't.
Here's a quote from, I just want to get to the interaction between the state and the medical community. This is Lori Lightfoot. She's the mayor of Chicago. Stay at home, only go out for essentials. You have to readjust your thinking. Be smart. Not only will our police be deployed to shut them down if you are not abiding by these orders, we will be forced to shut down the parks and lakefront. The situation is deadly serious, and we need to take it deadly seriously. Is that hyperbole, or is it just me?
Yeah, I think Americans have always voluntarily cooperated in the crises, and I don't like the tone of those kinds of pronouncements. I think that the president has struck exactly the right tone in praising the level of cooperation he's gotten from the public and from mm-hmm. private enterprise. And I think that Americans, when push comes to shove, will generally always do the right thing. I'm troubled by the tone. It sounds a little bit Stalinist to me.
Yeah, I feel like we're living in some kind of sketch reminiscent of George Orwell. A lot of predictions in the fiction world have sort of come true. I just watched I saw a post on Facebook from another source, and it was the lessons that the 1967 TV show The Prisoner can offer for our quarantine. This is the show, ran for one season, starring Patrick McGoohan, about a dissident from the government who quits his secret agent job, and he's punished by being put on this, it's a fictional island, it's actually a resort in North Wales, and he doesn't know whose side is on whom, and he's trying to figure out how to escape from this village, and he's basically under quarantine, and there are cameras everywhere, so everything is monitored. So, you know, a generation before we have CC, what are they called? I'm going to say CCP cameras. Those two. CCCT cameras. Sometimes writers get ahead of what's coming around the pike. It's interesting.
Yeah, they do. And I'd like to tell you another story about a doctor that many people have heard of, Dr. Li. Dr. Li Wenliang was an ophthalmologist who in late December noticed that the ICU was filling up with people with a new type of pneumonia. And on his private chat room, he warned his colleagues at the hospital where he worked that they might want to take precautions, start wearing masks and personal protective gear because there might be a dangerous new virus about. Now, Dr. Li, for having suggested to his colleagues that they take precautions, was arrested, held incommunicado by the Chinese police, and forced to write a confession promising never to spread rumors again. Well, again, he was one of those who tried to warn the doctors and nurses and, I suppose, the people of China what was coming, and he was censored for doing that. He later died from the coronavirus, from exhaustion, mm-hmm. overwork and from constant exposure to the virus. And, you know, the doctors and nurses in Wuhan were so short of protective gear that they would put on their masks and their goggles and their protective gear, their garb, for a 12-hour shift, and they weren't able to take it off. So they couldn't eat, they couldn't drink, they couldn't even go to the bathroom for 12 hours. And they would sleep in their offices, and they were worn down. Many died. Dr. Li is now being held up as a hero of the Chinese Communist Party, after his death, of course. Before he died, of course, he would have been known as a critic. Now mm-hmm. he's being held up as a hero. But I know something else about Dr. Li. One of the reasons he sacrificed his lives to try to save as many of his fellow Chinese as he could was that Dr. Li Wenliang was a Christian, and his Christian faith was very important to him. And so he died, doing acts of love for the suffering and the dying.
Maybe we can call that a pink martyr. Not quite white, but almost red. Yeah. Interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Any firings from the Wuhan Virology Lab that you know of? Any whistleblowers in trouble or anyone who's high profile who's been depersoned or otherwise removed? Is that even knowable?
The head, the director of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, several weeks ago, in a press conference, tearfully said that she would pledge her life to swear. She would swear at the cost of her life that the CCP virus had not leaked from the Institute of Virology. She was very emotional and crying as she said it. Now, fine. I think if she feels that strongly about it, she should release the research records of the Institute of Virology, and we can decide for ourselves whether it leaked from the lab or not.
Yeah,
that's right. I found her tearful. Her tearful public swearing to be a little too stage managed, shall we say?
Well, yeah, at the very least, difficult to interpret. Mm-hmm. Was it under duress? Was she threatened with something if she didn't? Possibly not knowable. You mentioned the ophthalmologist Christian Faith. As a practicing Catholic who's disturbed by the accord entered into by Cardinal Parolin and Pope Francis with the help of, now we know, Uncle Ted the Molester McCarrick, in his high-level negotiations with China. Have you spoken with Chinese Catholics who are loyal to Rome about their predicament in light of the CCP virus? Are you in touch with people who are Catholic inside China now?
I am, Patrick. I can't talk about too much in detail about places and so forth. But the conversations reveal that many Chinese cities are still largely shut down. Many people are still in quarantine. Many shops and factories remain closed. And so it has been a difficult time for the Catholics in the underground church in China, both because many of them feel that they were betrayed by the Sino-Vatican Agreement, and also because the persecution of the church has not stopped, even though China is still suffering the after effects of the epidemic. Mm-hmm. I should say here also that I do not believe the Chinese Communist Party when it says that it has no new cases of the CCP virus in China, that the only cases are being brought in from overseas. That's simply not true. I've seen some documents from local neighborhoods in Wuhan City where they're still reporting new cases. I've heard also reports where 20% of the people released from the hospital after being treated for the CCP virus still test positive for the CCP virus. Mm-hmm. So we're probably released too early. We also hear reports that there is now a second wave of the CCP virus spreading in China because President Xi Jinping is worried that China's economy has been shuttered too long. Too many factories and shops have been closed for too long. The economy is suffering. And so he's decided that it's better to risk the loss of a few thousand or 10,000 lives rather than risk the loss of to the economy that it would suffer by being shut down even further. And you have to ask yourself, if it came to a choice between sacrificing economic production and sacrificing human lives, what would the Chinese Communist Party choose to do? I think the answer is obvious to almost everyone.
Not to mention the loss of faith, the face rather.
Not to mention the loss of face. So that's what's going on in China. Very difficult times. The persecution is continuing. Everyone is being told that the Sino-Vatican Agreement requires them to join the Patriotic Association. Many are not willing to do that because they see quite rightly the Patriotic Association as being schismatic, as being divided from Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And they would rather go. I think Cardinal Zen has recently said it would be better for Catholics to go back into the catacombs than to join the Patriotic Association. And Cardinal Zen knows far better than I what the situation is on the ground in China. We need to pray for the Chinese people, especially we need to pray for, I think, our co-religionists in China, who are, despite everything, I believe, engaging still in acts of charity and helping their neighbors, demonstrating Christian charity in the worst of times, of course, is something that that Catholics have always been known for throughout history.
So just for those not really paying attention, when prelates who are very rah-rah for this Sino-Vatican Accord say that the Chinese government there is the best instantiation of Catholic social teaching, you say not so much?
Well, I had a four-hour-long conversation with Bishop Marcello Sanchez-Cerrando about his first and only trip to China. He was in China for less than a week. He was shown only what the Chinese Communist Party wanted him to see. He was feted. He was taken to banquets. He was treated like visiting royalty by people from the Patriotic Association and the Bureau of Religious Affairs. He came away with a very favorable impression of China, which was quite deliberately created in his mind by techniques that the Chinese Communist Party calls barbarian management. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You can reflect on the racist or the xenophobic, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
You can reflect on the xenophobic undertones of a phrase like barbarian management. That is the practice of taking foreign visitors and gullible, naive, innocent foreign visitors and feeding them a whole pile of manure about what life is like in China. He said to me, well, I was impressed by the lack of slums in Beijing.
Wow.
I said, well, the reason they don't have slums in Beijing, Bishop Sanchez, is because they bulldozed them in the weeks and months leading up to the 2008 Beijing Olympics because they wanted to make Beijing look like a new shining example of socialist progress. And people were thrown out on the streets, in many cases virtually overnight, by having their homes destroyed. And I said, just a few weeks before you got to Beijing in the winter, they had expelled 1.5 million illegal residents of Beijing, people who did not have residence permits to live in the capital city, who were there illegally, often sleeping 4 and 5 and 6 to a room. They were all thrown out of where they were staying with their possessions into the snow in the middle of winter and told to go home. I said, that's why you didn't see any beggars. That's why you didn't see any slums. This isn't an example of the socialist teaching, an example of the social teaching of the Catholic Church. This is an example of the utter ruthless regimentation of the Chinese Communist Party. And don't mistake the one for the other. And so the conversation went for 4 hours as I dismantled one after another of the myths that he had been told about the People's Republic of China. But a lot of people fall prey to these misimpressions. I'm just sorry that afterwards he hasn't gone back and corrected himself. But I think that that would have been going against the general wind that is blowing in the Vatican, mm-hmm. a wind that's blowing from the Vatican to China, a wind that expresses, I think Cardinal McCarrick once wrote a letter to Pope Francis in the early days of his pontificate, talking about how successful his trip to China had been and how well his negotiations were going with the Chinese Communist Party. And he said something like, you know, with God's help, I will fulfill the ancient dream of Marco, of St. Francis Xavier. Mm-hmm. I will fulfill the ancient dream of St. Francis Xavier, and I will bring you China. That was Cardinal McCarrick. Ex-Cardinal McCarrick.
Amazing.
Ex-Cardinal, ex-priest McCarrick.
Yeah.
Talking to Pope Francis. So I think the whole goal of many people surrounding Pope Francis is to fulfill his dream of one day going to China. And as I told Cardinal Parolin when we met, Pope Francis will never be invited to China. It simply won't happen because, as the Chinese say, just as there can only be one sun in the sky and not two suns, there can only be one emperor of China. And the emperor of China, President Xi Jinping, would never invite the head of the Catholic Church, who is a kind of royalty in his own right, to share the stage with him. It simply won't happen.
Let me ask a devil's advocate question to that, Dr. Mosher. Of all pontiffs so far since Peter, Pope Francis seems to be the most sympathetic to the regime in China, and this accord seems to be exhibit A of his friendliness to it, that several of his upper-level loyal lieutenants have praised the work of the communist regime. You'd think that Pope Francis would almost appear to someone like the current dictator to be the anti-John Paul II with his Peronist quasi-socialist background growing up in post-World War II Argentina. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Well, I do. And I'm, you know, quite frankly, it doesn't bother me as much that Pope Francis is an obvious socialist as it bothers me that Pope Francis doesn't always speak clearly on matters of the faith. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we depend upon the Supreme Pontiff to do, to teach everywhere and always by his words and actions the essentials of the Catholic faith. And on the China question, I think it's clear that we have now fallen back into the kind of failed Ostpolitik that didn't work in Eastern Europe. It didn't work in Hungary. It didn't work in Poland. It didn't work in the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. Pope John Paul II, Saint Pope John Paul II, was opposed to Ostpolitik. He suffered under it, of course, as the Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow, and he repudiated it when he became Pope. His successor, Pope Emeritus Benedict, also rejected Ostpolitik because he saw that it had been a failure in East Germany as well, mm-hmm. The other half of his sadly divided country of Germany. And so when Cardinal Ray wrote all of the cardinals in the world and said that Pope Benedict had signed the same Sino-Vatican agreement that Pope Francis had signed, what did good Cardinal Zen say? He said, show me the signature. He said, because I believe that Pope Benedict rejected this same agreement because he saw that it would sacrifice the faithful underground Catholic Church, possibly for nothing, because the Chinese Communist Party cannot be trusted to keep its word. Mm-hmm. And that, sadly, is the situation we find ourselves in today. And I hope that when we get to September 22nd of 2020, when the two-year secret provisional agreement signed on September 22nd of 2018 comes up for renewal, that the Vatican will say, no dice. We're not going to renew this agreement because while we recognized seven illicitly ordained bishops as legitimate bishops, you have not given Chinese Catholics the space in which to practice their faith that we hoped you would give them. Well, and so the agreement should be repudiated. It should not be extended. I think, we will see.
Sure. I think Cardinal Zen knows the outcome of that, about the CCP's history of not abiding by terms that are signed. I'm still reaching out to Cardinal Zen. I've got several calls in, as they say. I'd love to have him to kind of complete this picture of China. You mentioned Ostpolitik, and I know I want to kind of turn to the end here. Ostpolitik is the diplomatic MO that became popular under Paul VI and executed or implemented by his Secretary of State, Cardinal Casaroli, and it was meant to be a kind of detente with the Soviet Union and all the communist satellites, right? Is that a fair summary of Ostpolitik?
It was the idea of Pope Paul VI, but Cardinal Casaroli principally, that we could reach some sort of concordat, some sort of deal with communist regimes of Eastern Europe, and that we could mutually agree on a kind of mutual coexistence, that the regime would recognize the church and allow it a certain latitude, and the church in turn would not be critical of the regime, that they would simply live and let live. It didn't work out well. It was opposed by the great saintly Cardinal Menzenti, who spent, of course, the last 16 years of his life in the U.S. Embassy in downtown Bucharest, Hungary, where he fled in 1956 after the unsuccessful Hungarian Revolution was put down by Soviet troops and tanks. He opposed it, saying, you cannot negotiate with the communists. They will not keep their word. This is the same thing that Cardinal Zen, many decades later, is saying, but on the same basis of the same sad experience, that you cannot negotiate with the communists. They will not keep their word. And in this case, it seems to be working out even more poorly than Ostpolitik did in the Czech Republic and Poland and Hungary. And I'll tell you why. Because in those Eastern European countries, there was a deep cultural bedrock of Catholicism going back hundreds of years. And that put limits on what the atheistic Communist Party leaders could do, because they knew the people would not tolerate an open attack on the church. Yeah. So there was agreement on the appointment of bishops and so forth, but the final decision on the appointment of bishops was made by the Pope in the Vatican. It wasn't made by the communist parties of Eastern Europe. Now we've seen that turned on its head. We've seen the Communist Party of China now advances candidates for empty sees. And the Pope is expected to ratify or reject the choice of the Chinese Communist Party. But Chinese Communist Party leaders have said that the Pope cannot continually reject our candidates. He can reject one or two, but if he continues to reject them, we will simply appoint whomever we want to a vacant see.
Yeah, yeah.
All right? What that means is that it seems to me, on the basis of that protocol, that Pope Francis really may not have the final say in appointing bishops if push comes to shove. And the other thing I would say about it is this. The hope of the Vatican at the time the secret Sino-Vatican Agreement was signed a year and a half ago was they had identified 40 candidates to become bishops. 40 good priests, monsignors in the underground church, some actually formerly members of the Patriotic Church, but secretly loyal to the Pope and the Vatican. They had identified 40 candidates for the bishopric, and they presented those candidates to the Chinese Communist Party officials, and they said, these are the people we would like to see you advance as candidates for these empty sees. And you know how many the Communist Party has actually acted on?
I'm afraid to ask.
They've acted on one. There has been one underground bishop who's now been accepted by the Chinese Communist Party. So even in terms of parity, where you have seven bishops appointed originally by the Chinese Communist Party accepted by the Vatican. You don't have parity because on the Communist Party side, it has only accepted one candidate.
Right. And the regime will never permit the canonization of someone like Cardinal Kung, who was a hero to St. John Paul II. That would be a major loss of individual and collective face, correct?
Well, Cardinal Kung was the Archbishop of Shanghai and spent decades in prison before finally being released. During the Great Amnesty, which followed the death of Chairman Mao Zedong, priests who had been in prison since the early 1950s were released in 1978. Cardinal Kung was allowed to leave China and travel to the Vatican in 1979, I believe, when Pope John Paul II had been newly installed as Pope, mm-hmm. and they met. And Cardinal Kung was told, of course, that he had been named secretly in pectore, as the Latin phrase goes, a cardinal by previous popes. Mm-hmm. So that was a great welcome scene. And there's a beautiful picture of the new Pope John Paul II embracing and kissing Cardinal mm-hmm. Kung and thanking him. Obviously, Cardinal Kung was a living martyr to the church in China. And should be, you know, as if we go through the procedure, as the procedure goes on, probably should be one day elevated to the altars. Mm-hmm. But will he be, as long as there is the hope that somehow the Chinese Communist Party will someday allow the Chinese Catholic Church to flourish and not try to extinguish it? I pray that day will come. I'm not hopeful, however.
Well, the current man seated upon the chair of Peter recently said that the coronavirus is a result of nature basically having a temper tantrum and fighting back through the coronavirus pandemic because of the sins of mankind and the carbon footprint and so on. So nature can issue forth wrath, but apparently God doesn't send pestilence for sin anymore. Counterintuitive.
And, well, I don't think you will hear anyone in the Vatican at the present time, from Pope Francis on down, say a single critical word about China.
Mm-hmm. To some, can we say anything, just trying to summarize what you said at the beginning, and then we can say goodbye, about the deliberate nature of COVID-19, the CCP virus, as intentionally created? That can't be known, correct? Because the data is so carefully hidden by the authorities there. As long as we have no access to it, we can't know about its creation, really. We can't know if the leak was accidental from the Wuhan Virology Lab, right?
Well, that's why I say that the President Trump should publicly and personally request Chinese President for Life Xi Jinping to authorize the release of all of the research records of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and for that matter, the other biolab in Wuhan, which is run by the Chinese Center for Disease Control. And we would be able then to look in the record of the 1,500 viruses that are reportedly kept in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, many, many dangerous, dangerous pathogens, to see if there's a match between the CCP virus and viruses they've been working on inside the Institute of Virology. If there is a match, yep. then obviously China's responsible for its release, accidental though it might be. And if there is a match, then we can see whether or not it's been genetically re-engineered to be more lethal. That would answer the question for all time.
Yep.
If China refuses to release the data, then I think that should be taken as an admission of guilt on China's part, and it should be added to the reckoning that we exact on China, we, the United States and other countries of the world, exact on China for unleashing this deadly pandemic on not only its own people, but the people of the world.
Well, they'll probably release it if we request it, right? Is that crickets?
If they were not doing research on this particular SARS-like coronavirus, mm-hmm. then they may release their records. It would clear them of one thing. It would clear them from being the cause of the origin of the epidemic. But it would not clear them from the other charge. And the other charge is because of their evasions, their cover-up, their missteps, they allowed this epidemic to become a pandemic around the world and cost the lives of who knows how many people by the time the virus is finally done spreading.
Do you think the curve's flattened? Do you think we're seeing near the end and Catholics will be able to return to the sacraments where they can receive the body and blood of Jesus Christ, the source and summit of the Christian faith? Because a lot of Catholics are very disturbed that the bishops have banned them from the sacraments. No creative workarounds, no access even to confession. Whereas, well, you know, grocery stores have found a way. Banks and gas stations have.
We have, here's the workaround. That the Diocese of Venice, under Bishop Duane, has put in place. All of the parishes in the Diocese of Venice, Florida, are holding their Mass at the regularly scheduled time. The priests are celebrating the Mass inside the church. And then once the church is otherwise empty. But once the Mass is finished, and it's going to be live streamed, so you can watch it from wherever you happen to be, whether you're home or standing outside with your iPhone or your iPad, you can watch the Mass from a safe distance. And then after the elevation of the consecration, the priest will come outside to the parking lot and will distribute communion to all of the parishioners who are there waiting, 6 feet apart, as social distancing requires. They will be waiting in a long line, and one by one, they will come up and receive communion.
Yep.
That is the solution that we have in the Diocese of Venice. I do not see why, except in the real hot spots, that solution can't be adopted by most of the other several hundred dioceses in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. It preserves social distancing. It will prevent the spread of the epidemic at the same time that it allows us to receive the divine nourishment that our souls need, especially in this time of crises and distress.
Well, that's to Bishop DeWayne's credit. I was not aware of that. And if there are any priests and bishops listening, that's a great thing to replicate. I've also heard of some dioceses, at least in Poland, making confessions available. Again, that 6 foot gap and sanitizing the kneelers and the screen if need be on a regular basis. Because the faithful have a right to the sacraments, and I think taking us a little bit far afield. But as a Catholic, I wanted to get your take on that as well. I want to thank you for your time, Dr. Steve Mosier. The website's pop.org. If you want to go to /coronavirus, you can find out the latest updates. The example of after example that seems to be increasing now in number of big tech censorship. There's definitely a war on information. Going forward, we'll see how this video is treated by Silicon Valley. It's being simulcast on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. Again, if you want to join Coffin Nation, this is the kind of thing we do all the time. CoffinNation.com is the website, and I'll show you the Purdy logo. Here it is. Yes, CoffinNation.com. We've got members in 25 countries, and we talk about the things that matter. And we get high-quality A-list influencers and teachers like Dr. Steve Mosier. Steve, thanks so much for all your work. Always learn so much whenever you're on, and I know that the feedback's going to be super high for this live stream. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for what you do, Patrick. God bless.
All right, God bless you. This is a live stream hangout. The Patrick Coffin Show drops every Tuesday morning. Check it out. We're all over the interwebs. And with that, be a saint. What else is there?